Matthew 12 says, going on from that place, Jesus went into their synagogue, their church building, and a man with a shriveled hand was there. Looking for a reason to bring charges against Jesus, they asked him, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? Do you remember this one? Where they're trying to trap Jesus so they can cancel him? So there's this handicapped man at their worship assembly, and everybody knows him. He's the guy with the weird hand. We don't know if he's born that way, or if he had an infection, or if he got squashed in a quarry accident. We don't know how it happened, but his life has been messed up because his hand's not normal. And Jesus has been going around healing everybody, but the Jews had a rule that you can't do doctor things on the weekend, kind of like hospitals today. They said nobody who really honors God with their life would do any doctoring stuff on Saturday. And then they pushed this guy in front of Jesus, hoping he'll do some doctoring stuff and violate the code. So Jesus looks at the man with the hand with sadness, and he looks at the religious leaders with anger. And Jesus said to them in verse 11, if any of you has a sheep and it falls into a pit on the Sabbath, will you not take hold of it and lift it out? How much more valuable is a person than a sheep? Therefore, yes, it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath day. Then Jesus said to the man, stretch out your hand. So he stretched it out, and it was completely restored, just as sound as the other. Jesus points out that the religious leaders violate their code if it is in their financial interest. They say you cannot lead a sheep anywhere on the weekend. It's against the law. It hurts God. But if their sheep's in trouble, they get it out. If one of their sheep falls into a pit, they would get all of their religious leader buddies to help them pull the sheep out before it hurt itself. And then Jesus points out that people are more valuable than sheep. So yeah, if it's okay to help a lamb, it's okay to heal a hand. So he did. Verse 14. But the Pharisees went out and plotted how they might kill him. Aware of this, Jesus withdrew from that place. A large crowd followed him, and he healed all who were ill. The leaders hated Jesus for exposing their hypocrisy. The people loved Jesus for his medical genius. Hang with me. I'm going to get to the last sermon on Jonah in just a minute. Verse 22, then they brought Jesus, a demon-possessed man, who was blind and mute, and Jesus healed him so that the man could both talk and see. All the people were astonished, and they said, could this be the son of David? When they watched Jesus fix a person that was controlled by an alien being within him, I mean, this guy could have starred in any Halloween movie. Carrie, Exorcist, Halloween. This man had been out of control, broken, could not talk, could not see, and suddenly he can again because Jesus fixed him. And that's all it says. Jesus healed him. Doesn't tell us how, doesn't tell us, just says Jesus healed him. They said, the people watching said, wow, Jesus is as close to King David come back to life as anyone we've ever seen. King David to these people was like Winston Churchill to Britain in World War II. King David to them was like Tom Brady in Tampa Bay. King David to them was like the Hulk is to the Avengers. King David was the conqueror, the one who could save them, the one who punches the hardest. And the people said, whoa, Jesus reminds us of David like nobody else. He could crush our enemies. But a little later in the chapter, when he was asked to pick the Old Testament guy that he was most like, Jesus didn't say David. Jesus didn't say Abraham. He could have. Abraham trusted God so much that he obeyed him unquestioningly, and Jesus did that. He could have said, I'm kind of like Abraham. He could have said Joseph, who with God's help went from nothing to king of the world. He could have said, I'm kind of like Joseph. He could have said Moses, who led God's people out of slavery into the promised land, but he didn't pick them, nor did he pick Joshua, Elijah, or Daniel, although he certainly could have. Great comparables. Jesus was absolutely like those guys in many ways. Instead, when Jesus was asked for the one Old Testament guy that he related to most, he picked, Matthew 12, verse 38 says, then some of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law said to him, teacher, we want to see a sign from you. They said, how about show us your credentials? What gives you the right to act like, you know, you're God? Never mind that shriveled man hand thing that you did today. Never mind that healing the demon-possessed man. That doesn't count. We're not taking into account all the people at the hospital that you sent home healthy today. We want you to show us something that really proves you're who you claim you are. So Linda and I stopped for supper on a way to a wedding in Pennsylvania at Perkins. Do you know Perkins? Perkins is like a really fancy Denny's. Really fancy. They're mostly known for their pancakes. They handed us a 12-page menu. No joke. Who do they think they are? Cheesecake facts? 12 pages at Perkins. Burgers, wraps, salads, pasta, ribs, steaks, fish, pies, sundaes. 12 pages. We looked through all that and decided we just want the pancakes. On the seniors page, on the back of the menu, it said breakfast food half price. So we both ordered. And when we ordered, the waitress said, "You know that's for people who are over 55. And we smiled and said, "Oh, that's such a nice thing of you to say." And she said, "No, I mean it." And we smiled and said, "Okay, well, we're over 55. She said, "You are?" And I reached for my wallet. I said, "You want me to prove it?" I was going to pull out a picture of me playing pickleball. It proves I'm pretty old, right? She said, no, fine, senior's breakfast coming right up. People thought Jesus was like David. The religious leaders told Jesus, "Prove who you are. Give us a sign." In verse 39, Jesus answered, "A wicked and adulterous generation asks for a sign, but none will be given it except the sign of the prophet Jonah." They asked Jesus, "If you're really for real, why don't you just prove it once and for all?" And Jesus looks them straight in the eye and says, "Okay, I will. I'll be Jonah." Do you know Jonah? God's voice, prophet's choice, sailor's moist. Jonah tossed in, repents of his sin, dinned in for a big fin. First submarine, comes out green, preaches real mean. "You're going to hell." Sermon worked well. Everything's swell. Nineveh's not bad. God's quite glad. Prophet's furious mad. Do you know Jonah? We've just spent our last four Sundays together in his book. Hopefully you've chosen to spend some private time with Jonah during these past 30 days, because apparently so did Jesus when he was growing up. Jesus read the book of Jonah. He thought about Jonah's story. Jesus liked Jonah so much so that when he was asked for ID, Jesus said, "I will show you the sign of Jonah." Jesus didn't just mention Jonah in a footnote somewhere. He had Jonah's baseball card in his wallet. And before we head out of this sermon series, I wanted us to reconsider the prophet one more time and see three things that we can learn from Jonah. Number one, when Jesus refers to the sign of Jonah as the key to his entire ministry, does that tell us anything about Jonah? And if so, what? The answer is yes. As a matter of fact, it tells us that Jonah is a matter of fact. Jonah, real guy, bought a real boat ticket, caught in a real storm, really got tossed over into real water. And anyone who says differently contradicts Jesus, who treated Jonah as a historical reality. Many people will tell you that Jonah's fish is a whale of a tail, but it really had no tail, because it really wasn't a fish. Some who say that have actually had enough intellectual honesty to read all 48 verses of it, but they still think that Jonah is a fictional fodder kind of thing, kind of like Pinocchio, or Popeye, or Pooh, Winnie the. But if that's so, then Jesus is an idiot. Because Jesus said, "My best proof that I am Messiah is going to be the same exact deal as what happened to Jonah when he lived through the belly of the fish." Like, what if I told you that I have found a new way to go from exit 45 to exit 44 on the thruway? I can now cover that 7-mile span in 7 seconds. Wearing roller skates with a rocket on my back. And you say, "No way." And I say, "Way." And you say, "Prove it." And I say, "Okay, I'll show you." And I pull out my phone and I show you Wile E. Coyote on a Roadrunner cartoon. Said, "Look, you can do it." Then would you believe me? Or would you call the local psych center and say, "Looney Tunes"? So when Jesus says, "I'm going to spend 3 days and 3 nights in the heart of the earth," they say, "Oh, really?" And Jesus said, "Really, just like Jonah, that won't be the end of me. I will come out again." If Jonah is a fairy tale, a Jewish cartoon character, then Jesus isn't Wile E. Coyote. He's Goofy. Sometimes you hear kids climb up on the roof and jump off trying to fly. And if the roof's not too high, or if something's soft at the bottom like a mattress or hay or a younger brother, then the kid lives through landing off the roof. And you say, why did you do that? And he says, Superman does it all the time. I thought I could fly. Little kids do that, but sane people, mature people, adults don't imitate fictional superheroes. But when Jesus references what happens to Jonah and the fish and Nineveh, he is not watching the Sci-Fi Channel. In his mind, he's talking History Channel documentary. Jonah, sailors, fish, city, king, worm, all of that as real as you and me, actual, factual. So let me ask you, let's just try this. Do you believe George Washington really lived? Why? Did you ever meet him? Did you ever talk to him? Did you ever touch him? Do you know anyone who ever did? Do you know anyone who knows anyone who ever did? No. So how do you know George Washington lived? Well, John, we have paintings of George Washington. We have letters from and to George Washington. We have references in historical writings about George Washington, all of which could be fake, true, but we believe overwhelming evidence stacked up proving that George Washington, we don't know that George Washington existed, but we believe he did based on the piles of proof. I was watching a show one time about George Washington, and they were trying to reenact when he threw the silver dollar across the river. And they got some strapping young teenage boys who were probably the age of George Washington when he did it. They tried to replicate the feat, and the boys did not even come close. The silver dollars kept landing halfway across the river. It was terrible. None of them got even close. And finally they quit, and they concluded that a dollar today just doesn't go as far as it used to. But Jesus, based on the evidence he had, considered Jonah to be a real guy. As real as we consider George Washington or Abraham Lincoln or Henry Ford. Jesus said, you want proof of who I really am? Okay, I will do what Jonah really did. Number two, when Jesus refers to the sign of Jonah as the key to his entire ministry, what, if anything, does that tell us about Jesus? Do we learn something about him? And the answer is yes, as a matter of fact. It tells us that Jesus knew what was coming his way. They demanded Jesus give them irrefutable evidence that he was God's chosen one. And he said, okay, I've got just the thing. And he gave them an Old Testament analogy of what was going to happen to him. Somebody sent me a collection of the worst analogies found recently in high school English papers. These are the worst analogies that they could find. An analogy is a comparison of two things to help someone understand something better that he doesn't understand based on something that he does understand. You take something they don't know about and you compare it to something they do know about so they can understand. Here are some of the bad ones that they got from high school English students. Analogy number one, John and Mary had never met. They were like two hummingbirds who had never met. Analogy number two, the thunder was ominous sounding, much like the sound of a thin sheet of metal being shaken backstage during the storm scene in a play. Number three, From the attic came an unearthly howl. The whole scene had an eerie, surreal quality to it, like when you're on vacation in another city and Jeopardy comes on at 7 instead of 7:30. Like the little boat drifted gently across the pond, exactly the way a bowling ball wouldn't. And this is, I think, the best. A classic analogy, her vocabulary was bad, like whatever. Matthew 12 says, when the religious leaders asked Jesus for his credentials, he gave them an analogy. Jesus said, for as Jonah was 3 days and three nights in the belly of a huge fish, so the Son of Man will be 3 days and three nights in the heart of the earth. And he didn't mean he'd be down there spelunking. He meant in the earth, dead, buried. Here are the two states you don't want to enter into prematurely. Marriage and embalming. Jesus said, I will be put away. I will be buried dead. But like Jonah, whose life and work seemed over, but it wasn't, I will come back and I will do more after that. Jesus' foolproof ID said, Jonah. Which means that without question, Jesus absolutely knew what was going to happen to him. Jesus knew beforehand he was going to be killed, buried, and put in a tomb for 3 days. He knew it. He had studied the prophecies. He had seen the signs. He knew it was right there. And yet, He claimed Jonah as his guy and deliberately chose to go through with it. There is a powerful story that I never have used as a sermon illustration. And you guys know that I'll use almost anything for sermon illustration. But this story is dramatic, it's emotional, it's possible, it's great sermon material, it's been used thousands of times, but not by me. I will not use this because it's got one big problem. The basic point of the story is not right. The story goes like this. An engineer operated a drawbridge across a major river. He had control panels, levers, switches. The guy could set in motion monstrous gears that would lift the bridge for boats to pass under or lower the bridge for oncoming trains. One day, the man brought his young son to work with him, and the little boy was fascinated with everything. He asked a million questions. What's that button do? What's that switch for? Can I pull this lever? What's that about? Had a great day together, but after the man raised the bridge for a ship to pass through, at one point in the afternoon, there were no questions. There was no sound. He looked around. He couldn't find his son. He looked out the window of his control cabin, and he saw his boy out climbing under the bridge in the teeth of the gears. And as he started to open the door to go get his son, to his horror, the man heard the whistle of an approaching train. His pulse quickened as there were over 200 people who rode on that train. If he lowered the bridge, there would be no time to get his son off the great gear mechanisms. If he didn't lower the bridge, 200 people would plummet into the river below and die. A terrible dilemma with no solution and only seconds to decide. But the engineer, in the end, knew what he had to do, and he sobbed as he pulled the lever that lowered the bridge into place. And as the train passed over the bridge, he could see the passengers' faces in the windows. Some were asleep, some were reading the newspaper, mostly bored, totally oblivious to the horrific sacrifice that had just been made to spare their lives. Quite a story, huh? And there are many parallels to the death of Jesus on the cross. To save us, the Father had to permit his own son to die. How it ripped his heart out to watch. How people whizzed by the scene of sacrifice totally unaware of what happened. But the problem is the basic gist of the story is all wrong, totally, completely wrong. Jesus didn't wander down to earth and somehow find himself up on a cross. His death was no accident. It was not a last-minute mistake. It didn't take him by surprise. Jesus knew all along what he had to do. You can call the cross what you want, an act of grace, a plan of redemption, the ultimate sacrifice. You can call it whatever you want, but you can't say that he didn't see it coming. When Jesus gave them the sign of Jonah, he proved he was walking in with his eyes wide open. Jesus knew ahead of time exactly what it was going to take, and he deliberately went that way. Yeah, I think we learned something about Jesus through the sign of Jonah. Number three, when Jesus refers to the sign of Jonah as the key to his entire ministry, what, if anything, does that tell us about us? Anything? And the answer is yes, it does. More than you can possibly imagine, Jesus considers you valuable. He went into the belly of the earth to pull you out because to him, you matter. Mostly, we don't think that about ourselves. We don't think we're worth very much. How could we? People give us indications our whole lives that we're not really valuable. We're not pretty enough. We're not smart enough. We're not athletic enough. We're not rich enough. We're not popular enough. We're not fun enough. Our parents, even if they're really good, leave us wondering sometimes. Our employers fire us. Our kids ignore us. Our peers mock us. Our neighbors don't invite us over. Our church doesn't honor us. Our spouse cheats on us. How do you know if somebody really cares about you? Is it not because they sacrifice for you? Don't you want to sacrifice yourself for people you love? And when someone you love hurts bad, don't you wish you could take their place? When your child is going through some painful medical procedure, would you not trade with them instantly if you could? If someone you love was about to be killed, wouldn't you give your life up to save theirs? Jesus could, and he did, which means he thinks that you're worth everything. I did something very special for my daughter once. I took her to a garage sale. Yes, I did. Perkins, garage sales, I know how to show ladies in my life a good time. On our way to camp, we were going to a camp meeting one Saturday morning, and Carice saw a huge garage sale on the way, and she wanted to stop, and I said, we have to go to camp. I told her, though, if she was good, maybe on the way home, she could stop and shop for a while. That afternoon on the way home, we pulled off, pulled over on the side of the road. I was going to stay in the car and read, but eventually I got out and I started walking. Have you ever been to a garage sale? These things are crazy. They have DVD and dishes and antlers and shoes and turntables and bedpans and hunting knives. It's amazing what people put their junk out in their yard and they say, this is worth nothing to me. Give me a quarter. One guy brought up a lamp that had no lampshade on it. And he said, this costs $2? And the homeowner said, yeah. And the guy said, it's got no shade. And the owner said, that's why it costs $2. Fascinating. If you never have, you really ought to go just for the sociological intrigue. At this garage sale, Carice found Uno cards. Uno cards, still unopened. And she'd been looking for them all summer, in the plastic, unopened. And she was so excited. She walked over and she waited her turn to talk to the lady who was in charge. The cards had no price on them, so she said, how much do you want for these? And the lady said, 50 cents? And Carice said, 50 cents? And she handed the lady a dollar and said, keep the change. She was so glad to get the game. She paid more than the lady asked. She doesn't know how to do garage sales. What if you had a garage sale and you were selling some stuff that's been in your basement for years and there was this old picture that had been down there for a long time and kind of moldy. And so you put it out there and you said, like, $3. And somebody walked up and they said, I will give you $16 million for that picture. What would you immediately know? You would probably know, number one, that person really wants that painting. And number two, you might think, I may have misjudged the worth of this painting. By a lot, 16 million. But that's what Jesus picking the sign of Jonah as his identifying mark is like. He said, you are of such value that I am willing to be swallowed up to save you. Jesus is willing to die and be buried because he thinks you're worth it. That might make us think, I may have been badly misjudging the worth of me for a long time. Because if God thinks I'm worth his life, if he's willing to trade himself for me, I must really matter to him. The sign of Jonah. When our waitress came back with our food at Perkins, Linda and I had our driver's license on the table. We laid them out for her to see that we really qualified for this deal. She didn't even look at them. We said, aren't you going to proof us? She laughed and she said, you're willing to show me your license? You must be who you say you are. When asked, Jesus laid his ID on the table for all to see. He must be who he says he was. The sign of Jonah. And what it means is there is nothing Jesus won't do to win you back. No place he won't go, no price he won't pay, nothing he won't endure, because he thinks you are worth more than anything else he knows. And the thing that makes life worth living is to be considered significant by someone you consider significant. The thing that makes life worth living is when you're considered significant by somebody you consider significant. Last story. Let me tell you about my best day ever on a pickleball court. So I have been in 5 pickleball tournaments in my life. I have won tickets to the little theater at one. I have won a silver medal. I have won gold medal. I have won $25 to a Penfield pub. That really comes in handy. And in the other tournament I was in, we didn't win a game, but we had a lot of fun. So I've won a lot of stuff at tournaments, but my greatest experience that I've ever had in pickleball happened at Sonnenberg in Canandaigua. When I invited Jess to come play with me there, and I got there before he arrived, so I jumped in and I was playing in a game with some people that I didn't really know, and we played a couple of points, and then I said, hey, my name's John Walker, what's yours? And they said, oh, you're John Walker. I said, yeah? They said, you're Jesse's dad, right? And I said, yes, I am. Do you know Jess? And they said, oh, yeah, he plays here. He's really good. That was cool to hear. So we finished that game. Jess showed up. Then the lady in charge said, everybody line up against the fence, tallest to shortest. And I thought, what in the world? kind of reminded me of the guy who got kicked out of City Park for lining up squirrels by height. Squirrels by height, they didn't like his criticizing. But we really did this. 16 of us lined up against the fence, biggest to littlest. And the lady in charge said, okay, now we're going to pick partners. And we're going to start at the end. She said, Jesse, you are the tallest. Who do you want to have as your partner? And there's this one guy that plays there. There's this one guy that was there that day who is way better than anybody who plays around here in Rochester. He is so good. And I knew that if Jess picked him, he likes playing with him. If Jess picked him, they would clean everyone's clock. I knew that. But I also knew that in that line, there were lots of people in that group that would have loved to be teamed up with Jess. And we always talk about how we use our sports, pickleball, volleyball, softball, to make Jesus look good through our play, through our attitudes. We try to shine for him wherever we are on an athletic endeavor. So I knew that Jess might pick any of those people in that kind of an effort. So I stood there waiting to see which direction he was going to go with his first round draft pick. And she said, Jesse, you are the tallest. Who do you want to have as your partner? And Jess said, my dad? And the lady said, okay, Jesse's dad, your son picks you. My best day ever on a pickleball court was the day that my son, in front of a lot of people, chose me to be his partner. The thing that makes life worth living is to be considered significant by someone you consider significant. And there was a day when the most significant man in the entire universe, not joking, the most significant man said, I choose you. You. I know what it's going to cost. I know what it means. And still, I pick you. The sign of Jonah. Let's pray.